I'm Chris Mandel, director of the Sedgwick Institute. Welcome to this installment of Sedgwick Institute Live, where I profile influential thought leaders who make a difference and whose interests lie in the risk and insurance world. Today, I'm talking to Peter Duffy, who is the owner-director of Selexer, a strategic execution solution provider. Welcome, Peter. Glad to be talking to you from Ireland, right?
Yes, indeed, Chris. Thank you very much indeed. I'm glad to be talking to you and looking forward to the conversation.
Look forward to it. So, Peter, as I mentioned to you, I want to kind of kill two birds with one stone. We're going to do this as a podcast for the Institute and talk about your thoughts about high-performance risk management, the working title of my book. So let's start with just giving everybody a little bit of a short, maybe two-minute overview on who you are and what your background is and how it relates to the risk management world.
Sure, Chris. Happy to do that. Formerly an Irish Army officer, and about 25 years ago, I created my first company called Risk Management International, a provider of special risks solutions to foreign direct investment companies in Ireland operating across Europe. And in the last couple of years, I and a number of colleagues from an eclectic group of people from various industry sectors came together to create Selexer, which is a name comprised of two words, the Irish word solus for illuminate, and lux, the Latin for illuminate, because we help illuminate the strategic opportunities and the strategic derailment issues that exist between the boardroom and the frontline decision makers. So essentially, we're at the strategic risk end of the business.
What was, just to backtrack a bit, what exactly was Risk Management International? Was that a consulting firm?
Yes, a traditional consulting firm. It would be the most significant player and provider of such services, high-end corporate risk advisory services in Ireland, providing services to a significant number of, in fact, the US-based foreign direct investment companies in Ireland. And out of that, we created Selexer, which is a separate standalone company with a number of experts from banking, technology, and other industry sectors.
Right. Was RMI focused on any particular industry group?
Not really. Companies in Ireland that are headquartered in Ireland providing services across Europe, Middle East, and Asia in the context of service or product. We find that at the corporate risk end of things, that the big and basic questions, the issues, the problems, the challenges that exist across all sectors are pretty common. And so it's across all verticals.
So the firm, just to finish that piece off, wasn't focused on necessarily insurance risk management as much as the broader, whether you call it ERM or otherwise, the broader risk management construct?
That's correct. Although originally, back in 1996, I think it was, we did get approval for inclusion in Lloyd's and AIG special risks insurance policies. And that had the effect of positioning us very much at the corporate end. And at a time that was great for us because that was pretty much the beginning of the risk management sector. At that time, people weren't too sure, were we in the treasury insurance business? But of course, risk and risk management today is differently understood than it was some 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you're also involved in global standards issues as well through what, the ISO Technical Committee, is that right?
Yes, I represent Ireland on two of ISO's technical committees. In the first instance, Technical Committee 262, which is the owner, and it is responsible for ISO 31000. I would have led a task group, which was required to produce a design specification and the revision of ISO 31000. I also represent Ireland in another technical committee, that's TC309, recently established in November of last year, and its focus is on the governance of organizations. So risk and governance, two sides of the same coin, you could say.
Right, right. So as you or our listeners would guess from what you said earlier, your focal point really is all about what I like to refer to as this nexus between risk and strategy and decision making. And so I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of what you're focused on these days. Am I right?
Absolutely. You know, we've always been curious about the, when I say we, I mean, I and my colleagues in this company, Seluxer, have always been curious about the reports produced by most recently in 2012, the likes of Booz and Co., who did extensive research both in 2012 and 2002 into those major value collapse events. And they found that in both of their reports in that 10-year period, that in over 80% of cases, the risks which destroy value, which destroy reputation, invariably are the strategic risks. Mm-hmm. And SEBS most recently produced another report that resonates very loudly with the Booz & Co. report, saying the same thing. In the case of SEBS, they additionally identified that whereas some 86% of the risks which destroy value are strategic in nature, they equally identified that less than 10% of the resources within a corporate, through internal audit or elsewhere, are directed at that 80%, 86%. I would say that as a result of those two reports, that we in our sector in the risk management space are effectively, we're identifying and we're assessing the wrong things. Certainly, we're not identifying and we're not assessing those things which are killing companies, because we largely haven't yet understood how to speak business to the executive as well. We do not influence beyond the boardroom door, which is a challenge for the sector.
Mm-hmm. So you're all about kind of making breaching that gap, so to speak, right? Making entry to the board level where big strategic decisions are being made and affect the long-term value proposition of the company, right?
Absolutely. We see ourselves effectively, if we take the traditional three lines of defense model, we see ourselves building a bridge between the first line of defense, the frontline decision makers, and the second line, such mm-hmm. that we help in a very easy and effective way, super effective way, help the frontline decision makers to call out those business issues that most worry them towards the achievement of objectives. And in doing so, provide a platform of information where the folk on the second line can come in and support in a practical mm-hmm. and meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing that through a process or through a platform or both?
Okay, it's a blend of a method using various techniques, sitting on a platform. The first platform of choice that we have selected is the MetricStream M7 platform. We're currently in discussions with another GRC platform provider. And our criteria for those platform providers that we work with are those only that are essentially in the top 5 to 10, as reported by Gartner and Forrester. So it's a blend of method and technology, and we also incorporate techniques like SWOT, bow tie analysis, balanced scorecard, driving out information that ties in with management information, business intelligence in a format that makes sense to senior decision makers.
So where does the senior most risk leader, whether they're chief risk officers or whatever they are, play into your scheme?
I would have to say that there are few enough chief risk officers really play into our space or that we play into theirs. Most chief risk officers, I think it's, I regret to say in my experience, are people who look more like chief compliance officers quite often. Mm-hmm. And very few attend on those senior executive away days or weeks where the big bet decisions are being made, where mm-hmm. they can influence the risk assessment, where they're present, and maybe they're not present during those SWOT assessments. So, in fact, we feel that the CFO in so many organizations is a role that's, in fact, changing pretty much as we speak, particularly in the U.S., where the CFO, who's the custodian of all the underlying management information and business intelligence information that's being fed in to support the big bet decisions that the board is being asked to approve, the CFO seems, in our view, to be more like what a CRO should look like. But we do think that there is evidence that there are some folk who are turning up, in our view, who are capable of holding business conversations with the C-suite, and as a result, really influence beyond that boardroom door.
So your attempt to reach the right decision makers for the purposes of your business is really through the CFO, the head of finance, if not the CEO, correct?
Yes. Invariably, we're finding in the Fortune class, the FTSE 100 class companies, the CFO's role is more outward-looking. The CFO's role is more inward-looking. So the CFO, the chief strategy officer, quite often general counsel, those folk, and sadly, in few enough cases, the CRO. But of course, it should be, and I'm an advocate of the CRO being very much part of that group of people who are helping to properly assess those big bet decisions that are there to create value. But sadly, when we look at the Booz and SEDS reports, tell us so many of those big bet decisions are so poorly thought through.
Mm-hmm. Is your perspective on this primarily from Irish or European companies' experiences, or is this your view of American companies as well?
It'd be, I think, a blended view. First and foremost, from 25 years of experience in the business with European companies, but quite often working at the European operations of American companies. Being lucky, I guess, being involved in a significant number of major crises. A crisis, in our view, is one where we have an existential threat to reputation and has the CEO, the chair, involved meaningfully. Anything else is really just an incident. And so we found over the years, and this is anecdotally something which most folk would agree with, we find that the reasons that the strategic derailment issues turn into events is because things which are known and understood closer at the front lines are not similarly known and understood at the senior echelons. And we've been privileged, I guess, in helping to resolve a significant number of those issues. And we find that they're rarely complex. So that's the first observation. The second is, again, my privileged position of sitting on two of ISO setting committees, the risk and governance committees, working with colleagues from around the world who equally share their experiences. And we're all seeing the same things. It's the big and basic issues which are causing these major value collapse events. And I really would say that it's the last mile that our sector has to travel before we really impact on deriving value where risk can become, in theory, it is a net contributor to value mm-hmm. creation and performance, sustainable performance. But in fact, it really is still being exercised in a traditional way. But we're making progress as a sector, I believe. But for sure, our focus is exclusively focused on the performance end of the game.
So as long as we're at this juncture, I need to ask you then, where does insurance fit into the scheme of effectively managing risk, in your view?
Interesting question. I guess if we refer to the universe of risks, which most people understand that term, the reality is that, if I was to hazard a guess, folk might agree that plus or minus 15, maybe 20% of the risks in that universe of risks are insurable using traditional insurance methods. Mm-hmm. The rest effectively are being self-insured, and I guess where the insurance sector is supporting industry is through its support in reinsurance and captives and those advisory skills. But the traditional models don't apply to 80% of the risks because, quite frankly, and you're the insurance expert, you might contradict me here or challenge me on this point, but quite frankly, if you cannot put the risk occurrences to a distribution in a manner that obeys all of the required statistical analysis rules, then you quite frankly don't have an insurable event. Most things
sure.
that go wrong in business are just not insurable for that simple reason.
Yeah.
But the sector, the insurance sector, has a huge contribution to make but I don't have the disciplines in analysis that it can bring to bear.
Yeah, it's an interesting time to be talking about it, right? Considering these catastrophes that have occurred in Texas, Florida, and now Puerto Rico and other parts of the Caribbean, where, as you would know and expect, senior execs and boards are breathing a sigh of relief to the extent that they've got good property insurance to protect their physical assets.
Absolutely. But then, of course, those in business, you know, particularly in certain sectors, we find that, yes, we have cover for our property, but what of the business interruption?
Yes.
And quite often in certain sectors in particular, they're so CapEx intensive that you don't necessarily have much redundancy in the supply chain for the products they're manufacturing. So
right.
You can have your buildings insured, but perhaps you might have lost your business as well. And that kind of feeds into my earlier comment with regards to the universal risks.
So as long as we're on the topic, I mean, since cyber risk has risen to the board level in terms of urgency these days, and particularly in the last year, what kind of risk is that to you? I mean, does that fit into this strategic view appropriately, or is it out on the edges?
Okay. Good question. Great question, in fact. In my view, if I kind of start my answer by, in the first instance, saying that I think that very many CTOs are certainly seriously challenged. Many of them are under-resourced. Many of them struggle to talk business. Many of them, in endeavoring to explain the problem, talk in a language that doesn't really make sense and connect. So the biggest challenge, in my view, in the context of cyber risk, is not so much the IT issues per se, but the management of IT issue. And enter, therefore, then the CIO's role, the person who can act as a translator, pretty much, between
mm-hmm.
the business and the IT sides.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, isn't it interesting how, you know, there are experts in this space, and I'm not a cyber expert, I'm a risk expert, but there are cyber experts who would say, well, you know, if we simply were to apply some of the big and basic measures as, for example, advised through the likes of ISO 27000 series and so forth, very many of the vulnerabilities that are exposed today wouldn't have resulted in the breaches. So, but I guess, you know, I think you know, as time goes on, technology is new. We're getting better at using it in a way that's safe in our organizations. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is a bit of the Wild West type of thing, where we're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, I think we're getting better at managing IT and defending IT and defending information, defending corporate structures.
I have a friend, Yvette Connor, who is the Chief Risk Officer for Focal Point, newly appointed, formerly a Senior Consultant Managing Director with Alvarez and Marsal out of New York. But she's really emerging as a cyber risk expert, and she has some interesting opinions about cyber risk being pretty much the future of risk management in some sense. She and I recently wrote an article for CIO labeled Enterprise or cyber risk, the poster child for enterprise risk management. And I kind of like the way she thinks, because her theory is that because we're moving more and more into a digitized world, in effect, everything in the future is going to have a cyber aspect to how you define it as an exposure. And in that regard, she might be onto something, you know, about how central this may be to the future of risk management. What do you think about that?
It sounds to me that she's the kind of person that should be invited on, or maybe should represent the U.S. on ISO TC309, because I know that I'm having conversations in there with folks on the whole question of the governance of AI. And I think we need to be careful about the words we use. Cyber and AI, you know, where are the lines? They're blurred. And most ordinary folk who are not in some way expert don't understand the difference. But I think she's right. Of course, enter then the whole question of the governance of decision making. And within the whole AI sphere, there is so much, there's a gravitational pull to the black box. So we have design risk, model risk, so many risks within that, algorithmic risks, that need to be considered and understood. And I think she's right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk offline about possibly connecting the two of you. I'm not sure she can put up with the bureaucracy of the ISO system, but you know, I'll leave that up to her.
There are some good folk in the ISO world, and you know, the process is bureaucratic, but it's as much a part of reflecting global politics and harmonization of rules as anything else. But let's have that sidebar, yes, for sure.
Yeah, indeed. So, as I mentioned up front, I'm writing a book about high-performance risk management, and it leaves a fair amount of latitude to define that. In fact, I would argue that it isn't necessarily analogous to world-class risk management. It isn't necessarily perfectly analogous to best practice risk management. And so the reason I'm talking to you and others that I consider, you know, global experts in risk is because I really want your perspective on what high performance risk management might mean to you, because I'm really positing that, you know, it really depends on the organization and a lot of factors, from culture to risk culture to management style to priorities to, you know, structure, et cetera, et cetera. What are your thoughts about how high performance risk management might be defined?
How it might be defined, I might have to think about a bit more to come back with a concise formula of words, but I think I could talk a little bit about what I think good high performance risk management looks like and what bad risk management performance looks like. I think for me, it's quite straightforward. A high performance risk management approach is one that says something like, I would like to travel from New York to Washington, D.C. I want to get there within, you know, 5 hours, let us say. Because I have put a time bound on that, I now have a performance element. If I've got a person coming from a compliance internal audit perspective, he or she might be inclined to want to list all of the risks that exist between getting from New York to D.C. It's quite a different list. It's an entirely different perspective when you time bound it, the performance element to it. And that, in very simplistic terms, is how I define or distinguish between high performance risk management and, let's say, the compliance centric risk management. And in fact, I would congratulate COSO in its production of the recent revision to the ERM framework. I like very much the positioning of risk management as a strategic enabler, the alignment, the integration of enterprise risk management with strategy and performance. I'm afraid that so many of our folk in the sector are still bogged down, I would say, in the traditional approach of lists of risks, which have no bearing on front-end performance. So unless your risk management endeavor is not part and parcel of achieving heady objectives which are required to deliver a return of some nature, either in a PLC, in a return of return, profits to shareholders, or if I'm an NGO where I make a contribution to society, there's value either way. And unless you're making a contribution towards delivering on that value, then quite frankly, you're just in the compliance department.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if that sounds a bit long-winded, but that's a fairly simple approach in my view, which I think warrants something.
Well, and of course, value creation is that kind of flip side of risk, right? The positive side where, you know, you can take and exploit risk for value. Where then does the prevention or asset preservation activity fit into the scheme, or does it in your view?
It absolutely does. You know, a friend of mine recently opined that our approach in Suboxone here, and in fact it's not unique to us, it's unique to, I think, to people who are at the front end of thinking here, but he would say that our military approach to solving this problem is warrants, you know, that it's he believes he congratulates us, in fact, in our approach, because here's the way I would put it to you. In the military approach, we have flank protection. But at the front end of the military operation, achieving a given objective, that's where all the high-performance units are positioned, where they're punching through hard targets to achieve an aim. But there are various echelons in the military formation which need to be protected. Supply lines need to be protected. The flanks need to be protected. There are different formations used to provide that protection, different types of units with different skill sets. And so everybody has a role to play. But in the context of this conversation, vis-a-vis high-performance risk management, it's about those particular frontline decision-makers and those specialist units that are punching through those hard targets to deliver the return, either to society or to shareholders. So everyone has a role, obviously.
I've always said that, you know, most senior managers and boards kind of expect that risk leaders button up the exposure to loss as kind of the first priority. And when they've got that underfoot, you know, then it's appropriate for them to really inject themselves into trying to, you know, get the organization to understand the true value proposition of risk-taking for value creation. Does that make sense to you, or do you think I've got it backwards?
No, I certainly think that it makes sense. And quite frankly, it also makes sense at an intellectual level to the frontline decision makers. But the frontline decision makers, where the performers tend to be, those folk are focused on the top line, the revenue generating line. They employ folk to apply and operate and manage budgets to control losses. And they tend to be people who are, as high performers, seriously challenged, not enough hours in the day. And so when you come in to meet with them, they really want to have a conversation with you about how you can help them to sustain and increase, in fact, that top line, that revenue line. And if that sounds, let's say, aggressive in a PLC context, it equally applies in an NGO, large charitable organization context. If we need to do things that are difficult to do to get food, for example, to people who are stricken in a deserted island, for example, that's being struck by natural catastrophe. So the people at the front end are punching towards the revenue lines. And if you want to get their attention, you need to understand what keeps them awake at night and help to remove some of the worries they have at night. That's the way, in my view, to join the circle, to close the circle, as I say. And
really, even though you're finding that CFOs and strategy heads and general counsels and others are the people that you're trying to reach and talking to, you would agree that a CRO is the one, or at least a key player should be, in this scheme, right? It's just a matter of, you know, are they in the right job, or is their job properly defined?
Absolutely, because the CRO is the person who's got the skill sets, got the
abundance.
Or should have, for sure. And yeah. Too often, you know, sometimes they don't. But certainly by definition, the CRO has the skill sets and has the resources. But it's having that, not so much that breakthrough conversation, but that meaningful conversation with the frontline decision makers. Because, of course, this conversation is about high performance risk management. There are lots of risk management programs and frameworks underway today that are performing well in the context of the maintaining the control posture within the organization. What in the military context would say, flank protection. But, you know, the enemy is in front of you, rarely on your side. You need to protect your flanks so that you can direct most of your high-powered resources to your front. And so having a high-performing control posture is mission critical. But it's not necessarily going to help the front-line folk punch through the revenue lines. And that's what's required.
That's well put. It reminds me of my USAA days, you know, a very military-oriented organization run by senior retired flag officers and always using these type of terms in most of the key decision venues that I was in, including, by the way, from a marketing standpoint, destroying the enemy.
Well, I apologize if I'm coming across in too militaristic a way, but you understand when you go into a place like West Point or in the Irish equivalent here, the military college, at 17 years of age, there's a thing which we call frontal lobotomy. So our approach to objectives, achieving objectives, and being pretty relentless about what good looks like is something which just becomes part of your DNA and wiring. So yeah, I apologize for if I'm overly militaristic.
No, it's good. I like the analogy, actually. So what about measurement then? If we say, as you have, that, you know, this is the perspective you have on high-performance risk management, what's the right way to measure it and prove that it's actually performing at the high level?
Well, I think there are a number of dimensions. Net contribution to performance is the obvious metric. Performance is a future looking thing. We have an abundance of information in our MO, in our management information. But really trying to identify what those leading indicators of future performance look like is mission critical. And so what you and I refer to as KRI, the key risk indicators, which simplistically are those things that can derail our KPIs, are a key priority. But also what is required is measurement and assessment across three other dimensions. First and foremost, the mission, the purpose of the organization. Secondly, the vision of that organization. And thirdly, the values of the organization. Now that might sound pretty, you could almost say puritanical and so forth, but guess what? Isn't it interesting that an awful lot of the companies that have experienced value and reputational destruction are companies that effectively lost their way? The purpose became profit at all costs, regardless, and so forth. So I think there are four dimensions. There is performance in its conventional, traditional understanding, but then mission critical and just as important is alignment with mission, vision, and values. And there are simple metrics there that can be applied, and finding the delta then between where you're at and your alignment with those, once that's understood. And sometimes you can have a gap, you can have a delta, and that's okay. But you need to work out when it's not okay and then close that down.
Well, and of course, I think we both know that even today, with all the social consciousness that's emerged, you still have pretty unforgiving shareholders in public companies. You know, they want their profit, they want their share appreciation, and you know, they might say they want these other things as well, but the money tends to be the priority in most cases, anyway.
That is true, but there's a very interesting debate taking place just now. On the one hand, I witness, for example, the letter from Larry Fink to CEOs wanting more assurance of long-term sustainability, long-term viability. And then I would say a seminal paper from Joseph Bauer in Harvard talking about is really calling a halt to the agency model. And talking and you know, really calling out the fact that agency tiering and that model, in fact, is having a disruptive effect on the quality of decisions. So between the two, I would say to you that we're going through a rite of passage between short-termism and long-termism.
Yeah.
But the future, in terms of sustainable performance, long-term viability, which of course everybody wants, that ultimately is where we're getting to. But there's a rite of passage. It's not easy. And at the moment, the gravitational pull is more towards short-termism. And to that extent,
yeah.
I agree with you entirely
yeah.
what you said a moment ago. Sure.
No, it's a good point. I mean, frankly, because, you know, I don't remember exactly the statistics, but you've seen them, I'm sure, where the vast majority of companies that were, let's say, high performing 50 years ago, or maybe even only 20 or 30 years ago, are not around these days, at least not in their current configuration. And so sustainability, I think, has become a very important question to ask, you know, because I don't think anybody wants to just perform well for a decade or two and then go away, right? So it really is an important question.
Well, it absolutely is. And to the point you've just made, isn't it interesting that recent studies have revealed that the average lifespan of the S&P 500 company, I think, is something between 12 and 15 years now.
Shorter than I thought, yeah.
Indeed. And if I've misquoted those reports that I've read, I'm only out by a handful of years. So there is something interesting going on. Companies are becoming flatter. They're more like ecosystems. They're not hierarchical. They're more networked. I think the model is changing. So much is changing in the world, and that particular model, and you know, the balance between short-termism and long-termism, and the expected lifespan of a company. All of these things are indicators of change that is afoot.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Peter, I think we've covered the gamut. Unless there's anything else you want to add to this conversation.
Well, Chris, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity of having the conversation, sharing some thoughts, and happy to receive challenge and indeed some of the ideas that I shared with you there in response to your questions, because only by sharing ideas and challenging each other and taking a kind of dialectic approach to debate that will we find, you know, what really, and I, by the way, I would congratulate you on your endeavors in terms of the book, and I wish you the best of luck for sure, because people are looking for guidance on what good looks like and what high performance risk management looks like, and I hope
you
succeed.
I appreciate that. And I think that, I think I'd like to be able to say at the end of the day that there is no one right way as well, to give some people some flexibility and, you know, getting to bright or getting to whatever their ultimate goal is, which I think in most cases, whether you label it high performance or not, is, you know, getting great outcomes for, you know, what they do for the companies that hire them. So I appreciate your input to this question, Peter. Thank you for your time today. To my listeners, you can find my and Bill Kelly and Dr. Richard Victor's speaking and writing schedules, as well as other resources at www.sedgwickinstitute.com. Please consider joining the Institute's LinkedIn group titled Sedgwick Institute, where we dialogue daily on issues of importance to stakeholders in the risk and insurance world. Until next time, when we'll have our next installment of SI Live, I urge you to use your expertise and influence to make a difference whenever and wherever you can to make this industry better. Thanks again, Peter.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.